Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Marie Stinner, and I'm an alcoholic. And we have been cautioned about how long we're to talk. But you know what? Nobody told me this time I'm not supposed to use any profanity. They must just figure I got older or something since last time. But I'm real tickled to be here. Real tickled. More than most places I go. More than most places I go. And it's real important for me not to begin to tell you all of the reasons that's true, because there's a half dozen of some of the most special people in the world to me in Alcoholics Anonymous in this room tonight. And one of the things that God's grace, and if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you hear a lot about the word grace, I didn't know what it meant. As I didn't know so much else about Alcoholics Anonymous, the words they used here. Grace, the meaning of the word, is a free, undeserved, unearned gift. Undeserved, unearned. Sometimes I get a little bit spooked today in Alcoholics Anonymous because something seemingly wonderful will happen in my life, and I'll share it with somebody and they'll say, "You deserve it." And I just shudder because I think, "Oh God, save me from what I deserve." I mean, you know, as I look back on my past, you know, if I take it blow by blow, not what I got caught for, but what I put out there, we're not even, I don't ever want to get what I deserve. I've heard it said in Alcoholics Anonymous that when the alcoholic stops demanding justice and begins to cry for mercy, he gets better. So, anyway, I just went off on a trip, but it's real special for me to be here by God's grace. So much. If you're new, by the way, I'd like to ask for a show of hands. Is there anybody here tonight with under 30 days of sobriety? If so, would you just raise your hand so we could welcome you? One over here. Two. I'd particularly like to take the time to welcome you to Alcoholics Anonymous and to tell you that I hope it'll be as good to you as it's been to me. I really do. I am probably the least likely, one of the most least likely people to be a speaker in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know any speakers. I didn't hang out with speakers. I never went to conferences. I didn't have any money. And I didn't, you know, I just didn't even know this stuff existed. See, there were two kind of people all my life in the world, and that was the good people and me. And even in AA, conferences and stuff like that were like for the good alcoholics, you know, the ones that kind of had education and job and they were married and stuff, and they just kind of slid in, and one day they just was alcoholic and they hurt their family's feelings and they went to AA and now they take care of their children and love their husbands and wives. And those were like the good alcoholics that had money and they went to conferences and stuff. And then there was the people like me, and I just like I say, I'm the least likely, and the people that know me personally know that I'm pretty shy. And people get real disappointed because they want to, like, talk to me a whole lot, like, pick me up at airports, and we'll visit and stuff, and they think I talk a lot, and I really don't. But I've had a miracle in my life. I have had a miracle in my life. And I could talk all night long, but don't worry, Harold, I won't. But I could talk all night long about what God, through Alcoholics Anonymous, has done in my life. I mean, I really can. And it's very, very exciting to me. I want to thank the committee. I want to thank Johnny H. I want to thank Mary Emma. It's wonderful to see Joe. I'm so thrilled to meet Bob B., your Sunday speaker. We've gone around each other in this camp for a long time, and I hope to meet him, and I enjoyed Bill last night. Bill C., for those of you who weren't here last night, gave one of the most fabulous descriptions of the uses of pomade that you have ever heard. And I did tell Bill afterwards that I felt he had left one thing out, and that's that, you know, if you ever are forced to do a little bit of time in jail, you may not ever have to, but one of my great blessings was I got to visit the state of California a lot. Now, being born in Georgia and raised in Oklahoma and being from a fine southern family, a lot of things, they just really never meant for me to go to jail, but it was an education for me when I got there. And should you ever find yourself there, and they don't have any Neutrogena or any good lotion for your legs there, I learned some marvelous things in jail. I learned how to make mascara, eye makeup, out of cigarette ashes and toothpaste. I learned, I really learned some fabulous things. And one of them is that during the winter, when our skin on our legs would get chapped and stuff, and they didn't allow us to have razors because you know what you could do with razors. So the hair on our legs, just really got long. And we'd get chapped. And do you know that if you put pomade on your legs, you know, I've heard that men shave their legs to do sports and stuff. I want you to know that if you slick your legs down with pomade, no matter how much hair you've got on your legs, it'll just be as smooth as can be and stay that way. You stick to your sheets, but you don't have any problem with it. So I just wanted to pass that along to you. I mean, I didn't know a lot about living prior to Alcoholics Anonymous. Knew a lot about dying. Knew a lot about dying. You know, I just have to regress a moment. If I don't, I can't even begin to thank or talk about the people that are here. Because what will happen is I will be so self-involved that I will not do what I'm here to do tonight. And that's that I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope with you about a program called Alcoholics Anonymous and my life as an alcoholic. I told you I was the least likely person to be a speaker. Today, they keep asking me, this committee keeps asking me if there's anything they could do for me, just let them, like they told you to. Don't challenge it, okay? Because I got here, and they said, anything you want, Marie, and they picked me up at the airport. I said, I wanted the nap. They said, sorry, dinner. And then today, I want to go to an AA meeting real bad, and you should have seen me trying to get to an AA meeting in this town. Didn't seem like anybody knew where one was. But the truth is, I got to go to two AA meetings today. I got a half of one in, and when I looked at that program and realized there was nothing in between this morning and me tonight, I said, Lord, I need a meeting. So they took me to this one meeting, and it was so good that they had another one an hour and a half later, and I told them I want to stay for that one too. And that one was a basic text study. And if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have a book under title called Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's referred to as the basic text. You'll hear people from many podiums talk about, you know, everything I say is my opinion, and I want you to know that not everything I say tonight is going to be my opinion, because I'm just not smart enough to have those kind of opinions. But it is reflective of, that's not my opinion, that the text Alcoholics Anonymous is the basic text. The way I found that out is it says it right across the front of it. I mean, that's not one of my opinions, but we were sitting there and we read the three forewords, the foreword to the first edition, the foreword to the second edition, and the foreword to the third edition. And there were some lines in that text talking about, and one of them came to me tonight when it talked about how Alcoholics Anonymous was growing, and it talked about how nothing short of a wholesale miracle had taken place. And as I looked out over this room tonight, I thought, yeah, a wholesale miracle, nothing short. And it talked about, in those forewords, about how a new light had entered into the dark world of alcoholics with the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was certainly true in my life, because I walked, and one of the reasons I asked him to turn up the lights, I visit quite a bit in Alcoholics Anonymous, at least for me, and certainly more than I care to. And one of the things they'll do is they'll put you up on these stages and they'll put a spotlight on you, and it'll be all dark out there. And I asked Harold tonight, I said, please leave the lights on. You know, I spent 23 years of my life in the darkness. And when I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, I love to see your faces. The text, Alcoholics Anonymous, refers to it as the indescribable something in the eyes of the people. You know, and I love to see that, and that's the way it was when I was new. Another thing it said in the foreword today was that this miracle was being repeated all over the world, that simple talk in that kitchen that day between Dr. Bob and Bill, was taking place somewhere in the world at all times. And it talked about that miracle was one alcoholic talking to another. And I didn't have enough humility today in that meeting to be able to say to them that I was a speaker tonight. There's something called reverse ego. And it's when you're not willing to even say the wonderful things in your life, you know. And I didn't have enough humility to say to them that I was a speaker at the roundup tonight, and that I knew that all I was going to do here was one drunk talking to another. That's all. One drunk talking to another. It's just, I don't care whether I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, or the Salvation Army in Philadelphia. You know, it's just one drunk talking to another. I was born in Georgia. So there was something, some truth to what Mary Emma said about Scarlett O'Hara, and she didn't tell me that story till this afternoon. And I said, Mary Emma, I'm wearing white again. Now, I want you to know that I have other colors of dresses. I don't know what that deal is with that. I was born in Georgia. I was born on the Fort Benning Army Base, where most babies were born in 48. You know what I mean? And I was born and raised in the South, and moved to Oklahoma. And you're looking at somebody that needed an answer from the time that she was a small child. Ever since I could remember, I have been absolutely strangled by the manifestations of self. And if you're new with Alcoholics Anonymous, in that textbook, it talks about how do we know we're full of self. What are the common manifestations? All a manifestation is that you can tell you've got it. Okay? That how can you tell you've got something? How does it show? And how do we know we're full of self? We're full of fear, resentment, and remorse. And as far back as I could remember, I was absolutely strangled by self. There was no room. I was so fearful and I was so resentful. There's a story in the back of the text, Alcoholics Anonymous, called Women Suffer Too, which I think is real cute, don't you? I mean, I would have never known if they didn't tell us, you know what I mean? Very creative with those titles. But in that particular story, this woman refers to herself as having been shy, idealistic, and hypersensitive, oversensitive. And she talks about how she couldn't accept the harsh realities of life. And what she ended up was being a bitter, disillusioned cynic. And that's me. I can tell you, when I was under a year of sobriety, my sponsor looked at me and she said, you know, Marie, you want life to be everybody holding hands around the campfire singing. And life is not like that, darling. Now, I'll tell you something. The longer I'm sober, the more I believe it is. The more I believe it is. But we'll get into that later. But so here I was. I was I was full of fear. I was angry with the world. Some events had happened in my life. The 12 by 12 talks about it. Those events that happen during our character development that go on later on to color the whole fabric of our existence. I'm so grateful for the fourth step in Alcoholics Anonymous that tells me to go back and examine every nook and cranny to clean that stuff out. Because I needed an answer long before I took my first drink. I was absolutely strangled by the manifestations of self. I was terrified. I hated myself. I thought I was ugly. I made decisions based on the person you see. Marie Stenner made decisions based on Marie Stenner that went on to place me in positions all throughout my life. I made decisions based on self. I threw me away. I thought I was so ugly that if I ever did get a chance at a man, that I'd just have to hang on real tight because I'd never get a chance at another. Now, I've seen pictures of myself. There was no reason for me to believe that I was ugly. I thought I was too sensitive. I have a brother named Jerry, and Jerry's the kind, you know, if you're from the South, you know it's very important to have backbone. I mean, in my family, backbone was very important. And somewhere along the line, I got having backbone, being strong. Men call it macho. I got mixed up being strong with being mean. And because I cared, I thought I was weak. And to this day, I swear, you can scratch the skin of an alcoholic and underneath you'll find a basic belief system that caring is weak. You know, we don't like to care and we avoid it. You know. Anyway, I have a brother and he's the kind that tells you I hate you and I'm never going to speak to you again, and he doesn't. I mean, Jerry Neal has not talked to me in 26 years. And I have made amends. I've done everything I know to do. But he just told me he doesn't want anything to do with my kind. And he's never accepted. And I envied him. Because I was the kind that if you did something to me and then you told me you were sorry, I'd ask you to do it again. I mean, I just born with a hole in my soul. There wasn't enough. There just wasn't enough. Now, those were the set of attitudes prior to my first drink. When I was 13 years old, Elvis Presley came out with a very sad maudlin love song. And I used to lay up in a bed and it's called I Can't Help Falling in Love with You. And I used to lay up in the bed and just sob over that song. And I hadn't had a drink or a boyfriend yet. I was just like that. I just like that. Now, I believe for me, when I was 13, the first miracle that ever happened in my life happened. That was that our house burned down. We got the hell out of Oklahoma. You know. Now, only my God and I knew. I tell you, I loved to come to the South because I literally spent 15 years of my life running from the South with a vengeance. I had made decisions based on self and things that I was taught that I couldn't make it in life. Many of those things I was taught, I had ideas about what a lady was. I have three brothers and they were talked to about college, but I went to Cotillion and everything. I was supposed to be a lady, and ladies have blonde hair and pink lipstick. Okay, And I wasn't one of those. And I made decisions based on self and through the person you see standing up here away. And I spent many years running from what had gone on. And I love to come back here because I believe my God wants no holes in my soul. Absolutely none. And that I will be led, if I pray and really surrender, that I will be led through circumstances in life that allow me to heal. Even my sponsor told me when I was new that God would quench the secret desires of my heart, even the ones unbeknownst to me. And that when something seemingly terrible was going on in my life, I was to get down on my knees and thank God that it was happening. Thank you, God, I have no money. Thank you, God, this happened. Thank you, God, that I'm walking through the things I didn't understand. Because she told me that God, in fact, was quenching the secret desires of my heart, even the ones unbeknownst to me. And I would tell you that to this day, I still do those things. It's those little things they taught me of not just telling me to surrender, but how to surrender, that were very important to me. Anyway, like I say, our house burned down. We got the hell out of Oklahoma. Okay? And I ended up in California, Los Angeles, a place called beautiful downtown Burbank. And it was very exciting for me because they had whole cities in California of stuff that we didn't talk about back home. You know what I mean? And I looked around California. You know, there's a lot of nuts in California. And I saw people with dyed, big deal in my family was if you had dyed hair. Now I have to tell you, I don't, to this day, I don't understand what the problem was, but I remember one of my aunts had dyed red hair, and that was like, that was the worst thing you could do. It was the worst thing I ever heard. And I got to California, and here were these people with all different colors of hair, all different sexual preferences, all different, it was like, it was the first time in my life I thought, oh my God. Because all my life I had felt like I was breathing somebody else's air and they were going to find out any minute and snatch it from me. And it was, my mind just exploded. I thought, there's a place for me. You know, it was shortly after I was in California that I took my medicine for the first time. And for those of you who don't know me, I've never had a social drink. In fact, I've never been much of a social anything. I'm more social today by the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous than I've ever been. You know what? That's not true. I was probably more social last time I was in Georgia, and it was probably the sickest I ever was. But inside. But and many times today I don't cut the mustard, but I've learned a lot of freedom here. I've learned a lot of freedom. I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that if God could be for me, who could be against me? Because you see, the truth is that when I died my death out there on those streets, as much as I love many people in Alcoholics Anonymous, as much as I love many of the people in this room, when I died my death out there on those streets, no one was with me. I died alone. And if I ever pick up another drink, I die alone again. None of you go with me. That's why this is my program, and this is my meeting. And that's why it's my text, Alcoholics Anonymous, and I try to live it. And I hope if you're new, you'll get that. I hope you'll come in here, get your cup of coffee, and take your chair, and don't ever let anybody take it from you. Most of all you. Most of all you. I was there in Burbank, and I took my medicine for the first time. I was with a bunch of kids up at a Lover's Lane type deal, and they were passing around. They were kissing and doing stuff I didn't do, and I don't know what it where I'd gotten it, but I'd gotten hold of a bottle of slow gin and a warm quart of Coors beer. For those of you who are moaning, let me tell you something. I just heard a tape of a guy that drank vodka and Hershey's syrup. You know what I mean? So I think slow gin and I told those kids that I was going to go over to the edge of the cliff and look at the lights. And I drank that bottle of slow gin and I chased it with that warm quart of Coors all by myself. And that's the way I drank and used other drugs for the next 9 years. I made two brilliant decisions based on self at that point. That if I could just stay loaded till I died and never love anybody, everything would be all right. Because if you're an alcoholic, you know loving hurts too much. Remember I told you about that disillusioned, bitter cynic? That's what I had become. And I had a medicine. And I made those two brilliant decisions based on self, and that's the career I pursued the next 9 years, period. And if you drank like I did what you had to do in order to get where you were going to go. That's all. My drinking career is very simple. It was 6 months in institution, 6 months out, 18 months in. I don't know. I began to go in and out of institutions. And I never want to forget the first time that I went to juvenile hall. I was absolutely terrified. I'd never even known anybody that had been juvenile hall. You know, there's a line in the doctor's opinion, Alcoholics Anonymous, that talks about the alcoholic will reach a point where it cannot differentiate the true from the false. And his alcoholic life becomes the only normal one. You know, that first time I went to juvenile hall, I was absolutely terrified. I was the only kid in juvenile hall that said yes, ma'am, to the counselors. I learned quick, fast, and in a hurry. That's not the way you talk. Okay? And I also never want to forget that in the end, I always kept a few miscellaneous warrants out so that I could go home when I got tired. You see, in the end of my drinking, it had become normal to go to institutions to the point that that was more home than any place else. It had become normal to see every living human being as an enemy to the point that I no longer experienced it. You just didn't exist. It became normal to live in such terror of the police and rapes and brutalities that I no longer experienced it. I was just numb. It became so normal to compromise myself that I no longer experienced the compromise. By the time I was rendered sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, success for this alcoholic was if I came to from another beating and I was by myself. Because you see, then you weren't there looking at me and I could just die alone. That was success. And I don't know what happened from here to there. I told you I needed an answer since the day I was born, and I'm so grateful. You know, I hear a lot in AA today about people angry with their parents and things because their parents are alcoholics and things. And I'm so grateful that I have a fourth step that includes my mother's alcoholism, you know. And I believe today that if we look at what parenting really is, that my mother gave me the greatest inheritance she could have given me. You know, if it's true what they say about the physiological predisposition to alcoholism, she gave me that because, you see, I needed an answer, and I can't imagine what would have happened to me if I didn't have the allergy of the body. I mean, what would have happened to me if I had just had to walk around in the world like that, if alcohol hadn't scratched my itch? You know, because that's what alcohol did for me. It went inside and it just scratched my itch. It gave me some room in between that resentment and that fear and that room. It gave me freedom from self. I got some freedom from me. And, you know, it's like there's a line that was talked about in some other meetings I go to that talks about this man that went out and he found the most beautiful pearl that he had ever seen. And he immediately went home and sold everything he had to get it. And that's the way I felt about alcohol. Thank you, God, for that phenomena of craving that was so subtle and so elusive that I didn't even know I had it. That manifested itself as a restlessness. You know, I'd take one drink. I'd take a drink. And that's all I was going to have. That's all I was going to have. Maybe two. But you know, that thing would start inside of me. And what would happen to me is I'd only have a couple. But I'd get like real restless. Like something was missing. You know that feeling like just something's missing? I'd get real irritable, like my skin just didn't fit. You know, just, I only had two drinks, that's all I want. I'm fine. And I'd get a little bit more restless, like something was missing, and irritable, like if that guy shuts that door one more time, I'm going to blow his head off. And there was nothing wrong. And I was just discontented. I just needed some medicine. And I would decide to have another drink. Which just cracks me up. You know, something real funny has gone on in AA in the last 10 years. You'll hear people talk about, today I have a choice whether I drink or not. I'm going to tell you something. As long as I had a choice, I chose to drink. It was not. That's why I so love the text Alcoholics Anonymous. It talks about that we are people, the person like me. It talks about that we are people who have lost the power of choice. And I continued to drink based on that physical allergy and the mental obsession until I absolutely lost the power of choice. And alcohol owned me. And then and only then could I hit a bottom that a grace of a God could enter me and dispel that obsession. I did it till the wheels rolled off. I started seeking help shortly before my 18th birthday. And that's not been yesterday, folks. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm here to tell you from the first time I attended Alcoholics Anonymous, I wanted what you folks had. And I was not to have it. It's always amazed me in Alcoholics Anonymous when people talk about, quote, slippers, and I love it when they say, you know, there's no such thing as a slip. You make a decision to get drunk. Again, I'm grateful for the literature that when it breaks down in the third chapter, the three different manifestations of the the insanity that precedes the first drink. It breaks it down into three categories. And it talks about one of those categories being that upon being sober, we make a decision to get drunk based on jealousy, self-pity, resentment, or the like. And it says this man's already in a state of insanity, or he wouldn't make that kind of decision in light of the past. They're already in a state of insanity. From my first AA meeting, like I say, I wanted what you people had, and that was to begin a journey that lasted 5 years in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for me. And it seemed like everybody in AA knew why I couldn't stay sober but me. You've seen the people, especially if you've ever been a slipper, those people that get up and walk clear across the room just to tell you what a loser you are, and then they even quit doing that, you know. And that's who I was. You know, I'd be sober for a while and I would end up drunk. And I'm so grateful that Bill Wilson identifies with that, because he wrote about it in his story where he just ended up drunk. He was sober and he ended up drunk. Didn't plan on it, didn't think about it. And I, like I say, that began a journey for me that lasted 5 years. I want to tell you just a little bit about my last drunk, and I also want to tell you something right now, and that's that I smoke Camel non-filters, and I can't imagine somebody asking me to speak at an AA meeting and not letting me drink coffee or smoke. And now I will not smoke all night long to hear one of you, but I'll be damned if I'll not smoke to hear me. I could have stayed home and run my mouth. So if I have a tendency to get a little bit, you will know that's a time for a Camel, and we'll just move right on through, okay? But you be patient with me, because if I'm willing, you're just going to have to tolerate it. You know what I mean? Anyway, I'm going to tell you a little bit about what I hope was my last drunk. And And I say I hope it was my last drunk, because I have seen people with better programs than me sober a lot longer than me. Either they hadn't done the things or they quit doing them. I've seen them get drunk. So I say to you that I hope it was my last drunk. I had been sober for a period of time in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was not getting better. It was getting worse. You see, because when I stayed sober, it gets worse. And that thing that I had had with me that was like a blowtorch going around and around and around in my stomach that I had had for a lifetime, when I was sober, it would get worse and worse and worse and bigger until I absolutely could not breathe. And again, I'm grateful for the literature. Because it talks about in the 12 by 12 how oftentimes, and in the big book, how our suffering becomes acute and constant when we don't have our medicine. And that's what would happen to me. And I'd hung on as long as I could, and I don't know how long it was, but I could not stand it anymore. And I made one of those decisions to get drunk. I made one of those. And that drink, and that, by the way, I shot heroin for 9 years, forgot to mention it. minor detail. God help me. Anyway, that drink and that fix lasted me a period of a year, and they had told me in AA that I would go places I had never been before. And I couldn't imagine where I was going to go. I mean, I had a worse story at 21 than a lot of these people at 60. I just figured it'd be more of the same. I just figured it'd be more of the same, waking up with I don't know who and all of that stuff. You know, and I made two more brilliant decisions based on self. That is that I would drink till I died, because people had been telling me since I was a teenager, Murray, you keep living like this, you're going to die. And I kept thinking, when? I just thought life was an overrated PR job. I never knew why people like did it. You know, they had these children. I mean, to me, children were in a class with dogs and cats. I didn't know why they had them, because you just have to feed them, they go to the bathroom. I mean, nothing. Life just didn't make a lot of sense to me, you know. And people kept telling me, you're going to die. And I kept thinking, when? You know. And so I made a decision that I would drink until I died, or that something happened to me to make Alcoholics Anonymous work for me the way it did for you guys. Because I knew it worked. You know, there was this guy named Joe H. that was sober 26 years, and I'll never forget, he walked up to me one late time and looked at me and said, you know, little lady, you're your problem. And I'll never forget thinking, no shit. I mean, I was 10 years sober before I got well enough to blame other people. I mean, I always knew that I was the problem. I always knew. In fact, I took responsibility for problems that weren't even mine, which I understand today. I understand more in Alcoholics Anonymous. But back then, I just didn't get it. And so... I just did what I had to do again until I swore, you know, when I was rendered sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I say rendered because I did not make a decision to get sober. I didn't wake up. I did that lots of times. Every time I would be, I got sober, and it just, another thing that just tickles me to death in Alcoholics Anonymous is when I hear people talk about when I quit drinking. Now that just tickles me to death. I mean, like we had smarts enough to make that kind of decision. But I'll tell you something, I'm so grateful that I never quit drinking. Because if I thought for one moment here that there was one shot of Jack Daniels out there that I had left, you know, just one that I had walked away from, that I had quit, or one dropper full of heroin, I don't think I'd ever be happy here. But I did it till the wheels rolled off, never did quit. I was rendered sober. And I say that to you, and as I go on, but when I was rendered sober, I looked around Alcoholics Anonymous, and my worst fear by the time I was rendered sober was that I had just gone too far. That I was just too dirty for Alcoholics Anonymous. That no matter what I ever did, no matter how many steps I worked, no matter how I dressed, no matter how many meetings I attended, no matter what I ever did, no matter how much I act like you guys or whatever did, that I would never get that inside filth off of me. That I had just gone too far. There had just been too many hands and too many alleyways and too many drunks. That I had just gone too far. I was just too filthy. You know, that was my worst fear. And it seemed like when I was rendered sober, that the ladies in Alcoholics Anonymous had cleaned up their talk so much that I thought I was the only one. You see, men don't do that. Johnny's going to tell a story tomorrow night. John A., that, I mean, I love to hear John talk. You know, men talk about pen and linen closets and beating their kids. Everybody just laughs. And I would listen to women speakers, and after they would finish, I'd think, but did they drink? You know, I know about their children. I know about their feelings. I know. And please, please know. Please know, I don't believe in taking fifth steps from the podium. I know our book tells us to tell in a general way what we used to be like. Hell, if I got any more general, this wouldn't be my story. You know? But it was almost like, you know, white man speak with forked tongue. If you don't regret the past nor wish to close the door on it, then why won't you share it with me? You know, the text of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about the skeletons in the closet and how we should not be hesitant to revisit that grave. It says that in there, that cling to the thought, just in case there's a kid here tonight that's afraid, that you're just too dirty for Alcoholics Anonymous. I know there's one here. I know a gal that's sitting here tonight all dressed up, and she's just afraid she's too dirty. If you really knew about her, you'd throw her out of here too. She's trying to look like you, but she knows she isn't. I know that. I know there's a guy here tonight that's trying to pull it off, and you know you haven't cleaned the house. You know. I heard a man in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous who had white hair, and I'll never forget. He talked about the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous being an inside shower. You know, and I'm here to tell you, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'm cleaner on the inside today than I am on the outside. He talked about getting rid of that stuff. Anyway, I made a decision at that point when I was newly sober that if I was ever able to stay sober, that I would stand up somewhere, sometime. Now, I had a penitentiary in mind. Like I say, conventions and stuff like that. First one I ever went to, I was 5 years sober, and I was a principal speaker. And I'd only talked once before. Anyway, if I was ever able to stay sober, that I would stand up with what I believe only the dignity that a spiritual experience can give someone. Because like I said, if God is for us, who could be against us? And those promises have come true for me. I neither regret the past nor wish to close the door. I have a new freedom and a new peace. That fear of people has left me. And that's amazing to me because you were foreigners to me. I didn't even know, what's a human? You know, none of that stuff. But I swore if I was ever able to stay sober that I would stand up and tell the people where I came from in the hopes that there was just one guy or gal out there that was afraid they were too dirty. Where I ended up, quite simply, was I ended up a very cheap $10 whore walking the streets of Hollywood looking for some old man to give me what he would give me. In an absolute state of shock that I ended up like that. Because you have to understand, other women end up like that. Less bright, less pretty, maybe from different circumstances. And what's more is I didn't want to live like that. I was only living like that because I genuinely believed I could not have this. The best description I ever heard of an alcoholic is not in the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard it said at a meeting once that an alcoholic is a person who, upon ingesting chemicals in their system, loses the ability to care. You see, I wasn't living like that. I wasn't turning $10 tricks because I couldn't make any more money, because I wasn't pretty, because I had lost the ability to care. I just no longer cared. And it was easier to do that 10 times a day for $10 than it was to get dressed and smile and act like I cared. I had totally given up on life. There's a line in the text, Alcoholics Anonymous, another line that talks about the alcoholic will reach a point where he cannot envision life with or without alcohol, and calls it the jumping off place and says he'll wish for the end. And that's what happened to me. I reached a point I couldn't drink anymore. I lost the will to drink anew. It just was over. The war was over and I had lost. And yet I knew I couldn't be sober, and I started trying to kill myself, and I kept waking up. You're looking at somebody that's been dead on arrival more than once. I just kept waking up. And I'd see the white walls. And anyway, this is the part I'd love to tell you. What happened to me, to that bitter, cynical person, is I had a childlike idea, a notion come into my head, and all that madness and all that hopelessness. It was just a thought, not my own. I'd been around AA long enough to hear about this thing called the higher power. And I had been trying to die so hard that I got this childish notion that nobody got to die without God's permission. Because I'd seen people just, they drank less than I did, and they just go in the corner and die. It just seemed so easy. And I kept waking up. And I got this childish notion that nobody got to die without God's permission. And I got down on my knees, and I said what I believed for me was the first naked prayer I'd ever said in my life. And by naked, I mean nothing. There was nothing in between me and me anymore. Those resentments, those fears, that remorse. Alcohol had beat it out of me. When it talks about in the textbook, Alcoholics Anonymous, that alcohol beat us into a state of reasonableness. I understand those words. There was no more bargain. There was no more nothing. When I say naked, I mean there was nothing in between me and me anymore. Now, I didn't know much about God, except my granny said that Jesus could hear everything you were seeing and thinking. She's Southern Baptist, first Southern Baptist, I might add. And she told me God could hear everything you were hearing and thinking. So he didn't play games with God. And I got down on my knees in that pathetic state. And I went to, I understand now, to this God that pulls chronic alcoholics back from the gates of death. And I went to this God. I said, look, God, I don't know what's wrong with me. I've done everything I know to do. I've been to AA. They sent me to NA. The people in NA told me I needed the women in AA. I've been to private therapy. I've been to group therapy. I had deep psychologicals all my life, and I knew it. You know, I've done everything I know to do, and I cannot stay sober. Would you let me go soon? Now, I had dying in mind. And it's not open for discussion because I lived it. I believe a part of Marie Stenner died. And that thing that had stood in between me and the miracle was burnt out. And it was through a very strange series of events that I ended up in another meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. One you'd think I'd be thrilled. No, I wasn't thrilled because AA didn't work for me. And I knew it was me. I figured it was one of those deep psychological. AA is just where you, if you're a person like me, you just end up here. You don't get up and go to AA. You just, this is where you end up if you're not in jail or dead. You just kind of fall off in the doors again, you know. And I went to a group called the Allen Nest out in the San Fernando Valley, and they call it the sickest of the sick. And I'll be forever grateful those people were just as sick as they were. Because, you know, those people were just sick enough to believe that the power laid out in the 12 steps of this program could take that pathetic little 23-year-old girl and create a miracle in her life. See, if they had been a little bit weller, they might have said, you were a what? You did, excuse me, your language, dear. Don't you have any clothes other than those blue jeans? They might have done that, but they were just sick enough to believe in the power laid out in the 12 steps. Could take that pathetic little 23-year-old girl and create a miracle in her life. Now, the way you got me 17 years... excuse me. Time keeps flying by. It's been over 18 years. The way you got me was this side of my face was black from a beating, another beating I don't remember. I was wearing a rib brace. I had amassed 17 felonies in the courts. I had jumped bail on them because I got nervous. I no longer owned a pair of shoes because my friends had ripped me off in the hospital. And most of all, I had drank me up. I believe I am one of the blessed members of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I drank Marie Stenner up. There was no more me left. There was no more. I tell you, I pretty much spent the last 18 years through the steps and prayer trying to get back to that where there was no more me. You know, there's a fine line between getting empty of self. And there I was at the Allen S, and I just ended up here. And two very important things were said to me. One of them was that a gal named Jerry walked up to me, and she looked at me, and she said, "You know, Murray," back then my name was Murray. It didn't have anything to do with being Butch or anything. It's just I ran the streets, and they gave me a boy's name. And she said, "You know, Murray, you can't stay sober." And I was so relieved somebody knew. Because ever since I had been coming to AA, they had been telling me, "You could stay sober," and I couldn't. And she looked at me and she said, "You're going to have to find a God of your very own that will keep you sober no matter what." She told me to go home and to get down on my knees and go to God and ask him to keep me sober, not help me stay sober, but to keep me sober. And to get on my knees at night and thank him and to be at AA meetings in between. Now, this is the biggest grace. I'm sure people had told me that before. I just never heard it. And the biggest grace is that I did it. I did it. I to this day, I can't believe that happened. And I will tell you that that's the only thing I changed in the 5 years I went in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, having studied the text Alcoholics Anonymous and the literature, I understand that that is the basis of our whole program. That is, it refers in the text 100% hopeless apart from divine help. That doesn't leave a lot to the imagination. The 12 by 12 talking about, it is truly awful to admit that glass in hand, we've warped our minds. Oh, I was so relieved to know that they knew my mind was warped. That we've warped our minds into such a pattern of destructive drinking that nothing but an act of providence can remove it from us. You know, and it, I mean, all of those things, I understand that today. And I went home and I remember my first attempts at prayer. You know, come on, I did. It wasn't like I prayed a lot on the streets. I mean, you know, I didn't know how to pray. And I remember those people in the alley, I didn't have any place to live. They just passed me around and stuff like that. And I remember going home and getting on my knees, and it's like, how do you pray? You know, the big book talks about, or the 12 by 12 talks about, that the only people that don't believe in prayer are those people that have not tried it enough. You know. And I believe I was given a grace that I got down on my knees, and I remember those first attempts at prayer, and I said, "God, God," I mean, "God," I try the silent, you know, the inside deal, you know, where you just don't say anything outside. And I remember the awkwardness, how stupid I felt. And how the room was real big, and when I would say "God," it would go "God, God, God, God." The room was huge and empty, and I felt on my skin, and I just felt stupid. But the grace is that I continued to do it. I don't even know why. I don't even want. And I don't know if it was 6 months, 8 months. I don't know what period of time it was that it happened. That when I would get down on my knees, that the room wasn't real big anymore. It seemed small. And it wasn't cold, and it wasn't empty. It was warm. And my words weren't going off into nowhere. They seemed to be being met. There was something there. Those are experiences. You know, if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, the people of Alcoholics Anonymous cannot keep you sober. We can walk the journey with you. We can share with you what we've done. But when the text Alcoholics Anonymous in the third chapter at the end talks about, once again, the alcoholic at certain times have no effective mental defense against the first drink. That defense, except in a few rare cases, that defense cannot come from anyone. It must come from a power greater than ourselves. What that means to this alcoholic, what the first step we admitted we were powerless over alcohol and our lives had become unmanageable means to me, is that regardless of how many meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous I've been to in the last 18 years, no matter what I've read on alcoholism, no matter how much I've studied the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous, no matter how much I've studied the tool, no matter what I know, someday, somewhere, sometime, it's going to be the bottle and me, and the bottle's going to win. The bottle's going to win. Unless there's something in between me and that thought of a drink. And that, in my case, has been a power greater than myself. That's what being powerless. I am as powerless today over alcohol as I was back then. And I know that. That's why each morning that I get up, and you can make fun of me. I've been made fun of for years in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I'm going to tell you something. I was made of, fun of and ridiculed before I got here. So I was used to ridicule. So it didn't make any difference what people say to me today. But I'm going to tell you something, because it's very childish and childlike. But each day that I get a start my day, I get down on my knees. For pages 86 and 87 and where it talks about, I ask for spiritual brain surgery. Now you can make fun of that if you want. It says that we ask God to direct our thinking. And I ask for spiritual brain surgery. I ask God to keep me sober, to put that thing inside of me, in my mind, that the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous talks about, that sanity, that if I am tempted, I will recoil as if from a hot flame. And so I do that daily. I got down on my knees, I asked God to keep me sober, and I'd thank Him at night, and I'd be at AA meetings in between. And I slept on people's floors, and it didn't get better for me, it got worse. You know, that thing. Oh, that first year. I mean, there were some times I would hang on by my bloody fingernail. I had to live. I would hear other people speak, and I would have to listen. Look through the eyes of other people in AA when they would tell me, they told me incredible things, like they told me, Marie, you're an absolutely beautiful child of God. You are not bad. You are sick. They believed, they had a vision for me, and I didn't believe it. And I couldn't think my own thoughts, because when I did, they were bitter and cynical. You know this isn't going to work for you. Why are you even trying? You've never made it before. It's just going to happen again. Why are you sticking around? Alcoholism, the insanity that precedes the first drink. Thank God I was here long enough to learn. They told me to take 1 year out of my life to learn about the disease of alcoholism and how it manifests itself in my life. And I'm so grateful that we didn't have a lot of literature then, and they just gave me the Big Book, and they figured that was, you know, the best thing there was. And that's where we learned about alcoholism back then. I still think it's real fine. But I became a student of the text Alcoholics Anonymous. And I just would study. I couldn't really read or anything. I didn't even know what the words meant. But I remember at my home group, this guy, there was a guy that was No, he was blind. And back then they didn't have the big book on tapes. And he used to talk about how he'd put the big book under his pillow at night and sleep on it. And he really believed that if God saw that. I know these are childish things. But you see, in Alcoholics Anonymous, they spoke to my soul. They told me stories. I wasn't... If you got real philosophical on me, you lost me. Because there's a guy in my home group talks about, if it weren't for brain damage, I'd be too smart to make this program. Well, one of my worst fears when I told you I drank me up, like something happened to my brain. I couldn't remember anything. And they told me things like, you lose your mind to come to your senses. That Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of the soul, a spiritual way of life. That you could leave your brain outside. That there have been lots of people too smart to make this program, but nobody too dumb. You know, and they just told me, and I believed them, that was the grace. And I became a student, and the days began to pass, and they mounted up, and it was unbelievable. I remember going to my sponsor when I was a few months sober, and you know, there's a lot of talk around Alcoholics Anonymous today about self-love and self-esteem, and I'm so glad they didn't have that. Because in my case, self by any other name is still self. And you know how they tell you go home and look in the mirror and say, I love you and all that. Well, I'd try and do that stuff. I love you. And it was just the geekiest thing I'd ever done. And then I just hated myself because that stuff, I just get more self-obsessed. And so they talked about freedom from self. And I have very little self-love today, but I do value myself because I've had a miracle in my life. I've had a miracle in my life. You know, so I value myself. I try to treat myself the way those people in Alcoholics Anonymous treated me 18 years ago and continue to treat me. Because if I don't, their kindness, it's like slapping them in the face. It's like saying, thanks for your gift, But I would have all this madness going on, and I remember going over to my sponsors one day, and she said, one more bad thing about me. And she said, Marie, I've heard enough about the bad things about you. Let's talk about something good. I said, there isn't anything. And she said, well, let's start with the obvious. You're pretty. And I said, I use my looks for the wrong reason. Don't count. And this woman, in frustration, finally just to shut me up. This is the kind of stuff I know y'all guys have, like, fear of intimacy and different big words they use. But this is kind of stuff they told me back then was, finally my sponsor just got aggravated with me and she looked at me and she said, you know what, Marie? An open window by its very nothingness serves a purpose. And she turned around and walked away. Now, wait a minute. I walked away from there. God, you got it. I'm real embarrassed to tell you I was this sick, but thank you, God, this stuff saved my life. And I walked away from there, and I thought about an open window. And I thought, wait a minute. If somebody has cancer, or if they're dying, and they're in a bed, an open window is their whole world. It brings in sunshine. It brings in light. It could, just because it's open, it lets something shine through. It can bring in a breeze. It brings in smells. And I started to walk away and think, God, I don't have to go anywhere, get anything, be anything. If I could just be like that. If I could just be like a window. And they talked a lot about learning to have our outsides match our insides. My group, we didn't talk about acting as if. We talked about having our outsides match our insides and learn to call things by their right name. I remember people saying to me things like, Marie, what you are speaks so loudly. I can't hear a word you're saying. Because I thought I had to tell them about my case. You know, the newcomers, where you feel like they run up to you and they got to tell you, but you don't understand. I do, blah, blah. And they think you've never met one before and they've got to tell you all about it. Well, I just thought I had to tell them why I couldn't stay sober and what a waste of time it was for me. And they'd say those things. What you are speaks so loudly, Maria, I can't hear a word you're saying. And I really knew that these people knew things here. And I began a spiritual journey. I'd like to tell you some things that have happened in the last few years. I just went about the business of living, became a student of the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous, lived as much as I could, went to institutions, and when I was 5 years sober, I got a phone call one day from a lady named Elsie Faye Maroney that asked me, would I be a speaker at a convention? Now, people ask me how you get started. I love this one. The circuit, how do you get signed up for the circuit? Who knows? I don't know. Well, do you send tapes to people? Well, I didn't do any of that stuff. I just got a call one day. And I was so stupid. And I believed everything I'd ever heard. I believed God chose speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hear people say, well, I'm leaving. I've heard this guy 5 times. Well, I was taught if I heard him 5 times, it was because he had something to say to me. You know? And so I listened. Anyway, I was asking, I stood up on this stage and I told my story about little girl gone astray, end up on a street corner, and God comes along and saves her, and by now I'm married to a scientist. I think it's hysterical. I have this little boy. I have this little baby boy. And all in all, it was just quite a miracle story, and I started bawling in the middle of it. I had never told my story in front of dressed up drunks. And I thought it was a one-shot deal. I thought it was I didn't know about traveling. I didn't know any of this. I thought it was a one-shot deal. It was my day to say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous as I stood up there in my dress and I showed him what they had done for me. Everything that I am, the way I dress today, the way I walk, the way I talk, everything that I am, the people, through the people of Alcoholics Anonymous has made of me. Absolutely nothing that I am today was I before I got here. Absolutely nothing. Alcoholics Anonymous did not give me back a life. It gave me one for the first time. And there I was, I thought it was a one-shot deal. And within 6 months, I had been asked to 6 major conventions in and out of the country. And I started traveling. And what happened to me is I got introduced to an Alcoholics Anonymous I never knew existed. I really believed if you were 15 years sober, you didn't gossip. I really believed if you were married to your wife or vice versa, that y'all guys only slept with each other. I really believed everything people told me. And you can say, how was I that ignorant and how was I stupid? Number one, it was a miracle I was that ignorant because I had always been cynical and bitter. To even to have become a Pollyanna was a miracle. And I believe for me that God held me in the palm of his hand. Because you see, my life had been so horrible before I got here that I had to believe that what you were saying was true. I had to believe that there was a different way of life for me here. I had to believe it, and I believe God held me in the palm of his hand. And I have been taught, and Dr. Tebow talks about in the in AA Comes of Age, which I believe is an underrated book, but it talks about the recuperative powers of the human ego. And to ever to assume that the ego is dead and buried, and I started the recuperative powers of that human ego is I start getting scared. And I start getting resentful. And I start hating myself. I started looking around AA. And I started, this one doesn't walk like he talks. It's a very dangerous thing that starts happening around 5 years sober. Very dangerous thing. Very dangerous. It is my opinion, at least based on my own experience, by the time I was 5 years sober, the ego was full blown again. It had been creeping back up. All those fears, those resentments, and the new name, same game. And I'm traveling around Alcoholics Anonymous sharing my story about little girls gone astray, and I'm confused and I'm frightened. And 5 years sober is a big chunk. And that marriage is not going so well. And that beautiful blonde-eyed baby has now become a financial burden. I don't know what to do with a child. I'm like, woo, woo, woo. You know, What do you teach him to? I don't care if he ties his shoes. I'm just waiting for him to take a drink so he could come to you guys. You could raise him. I don't know for mother. I don't know what to do with this creature. And I'm going around AA and people are telling me I'm fine. And I start saying to people, something's wrong. Something's wrong. And no, they're saying, keep sharing. Get out of yourself. That's just self-obsession. And I keep going and I keep going and I keep going. But something's wrong. And I know my house isn't in order. And the inside job's not there. I want to tell you a little bit what happened to me when I was 9 and a half years sober. This is after having sat at the right hand of Chuck Chamberlain, after having spoken at the Atlanta Roundup, after having done a lot of things in the country. And I'll tell you why I'm going to tell it to you. Because nobody was talking about it. And I almost died because I thought I was the only one. I didn't know that it was manifestation. I did not know what was going on. 9 and a half years sober. That beautiful scientist husband had been sober 7 years. Got drunk. Everybody in AA rushed in to help my husband. I was hanging on by my bloody fingernails, and people were saying to me, what you going to do about that self-pity, Marie? That beautiful child, like I say, things were not right. And I was hanging on, trying to be of service, trying to be grateful today I'm sober. And I'm not. And I got to experience what I believe for me has been the second greatest blessing in Alcoholics Anonymous between the grace that I received when I first got here. As I got to 9 and a half years sober, experienced the obsession to drink. I had never had it. I always said that if it were up to the bottle of me, the bottle would win. So God always removed it from me. 9 and a half years sober, I got to experience the obsession of drink, and I will tell you, for over 2 months, I was absolutely obsessed with the thought of a drink from the time I woke up in the morning till when I went to bed at night. And this is the way it went for me. Do I have to get drunk to be deserving of the people's love in AA? I don't want to be 9 and a half years sober anymore. I remembered when I was new and they'd walk up to me. I mean, if you tell them you rob a bank, you say, did you drink, kid? Nah, then you're a success. I just wanted somebody to tell me that I was a success again. I didn't want to be 9 and a half years old. I didn't want to be a speaker. I didn't want to be a mother. I didn't want to be a wife. I didn't want to be any of that. I just wanted to be a success again. I got down on my knees and I said another one of those naked prayers. Also, I was very ashamed to go into AA and tell the people what was going on with me. I realize now it frightened a lot of them, because if it could happen to me, it might happen to them. You know. And I got down on my knees and I said another one of those naked prayers. And I said, God, I no longer care if I'm sober. Now, I know that's heresy. But I said, I do not have self-love or whatever they're talking about in AA. I do not care enough to live through this. But if you keep me sober, I promise you that I will talk about this in AA. Now, it was through another very strange series of events, including a letter that went to 5 different addresses, very strange series of events, that I ended up back at that home group again that was 3 states away. And thank God they hadn't heard of fear of abandonment or deep psychologicals. Old guy named Carl Jantz looked at me and said, I was telling him everything going on in my life, and he looked at me and he said, baby, resentment and self-pity by any other name are still resentment and self-pity. Now, see, I was so sick when I was new in AA, I thought self-pity, I didn't know what it meant either. I thought self-pity was if you felt sorry for yourself when you didn't have a reason. And I had reasons. I mean, this AA deal didn't pay off. I had done it all. I had subjected each sex situation to the test, was it selfish or not? And I had gone on those stupid 12-step calls, and I had gone to Ontario and Upland and, oh, Christ every place they asked. I mean, I'd done it. And it didn't pay off. It wasn't supposed to. And I saw liars and cheaters and thieves in AA that were getting richer and sleeping with people. I mean, they had wonderful lives. He told me to go get a legal pad and a pencil paper. And I wrote an inventory as if I never wrote one. And I wrote out all those resentments and what those people had done to me. And anyone in Alcoholics Anonymous that tells you that we don't take the other person's inventory has not read the text Alcoholics Anonymous. I stayed confused so long because it seemed like Bill Wilson was taking Mr. Brown's inventory. We do, okay? We take theirs, we take ours, but we only benefit from ours. We have to pray for them. Okay, but I wrote an inventory as if I had never written one. And what had happened, when I tell you that it was a great benefit, is it's no longer in theory to me in Alcoholics Anonymous that resentment shuts us off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity that is alcohol returns, and we drink. We drink. So my house had gotten very dirty. My house, and I'm here to report that the steps worked as well at 9.5 years sober as they did when I was new. And never have I allowed my house to get that dirty again. Dr. Tebow talks about repeated inventories, not just one. Now, that's what he told Bill Wilson, so I figure it's good enough for Bill Wilson, good enough for me, right? What the hell? Anyway, I started more of a journey, and I learned more in AA. For me, when we read chapter 5, it talks about that this is a way of life in which we grasp and develop a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. You know, if you're here 5 years, I have no doubt you have grasped a way of living that demands rigorous honesty. It's the developing that never ends. And the good news is, and I want to close with this, the good news is that it's gotten better. And I want to tell you that. You know, somebody said to me last night something about, oh, it's nice to know you're still crazy at 18 years. And I looked at him real quick and I said, I want to tell you something, I'm not crazy. We hear a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous about, oh, well, I'm sober 20 years. I'm just crazy as long. I want you to know something. I'm not crazy anymore. And anybody that's ever been really crazy wouldn't make jokes about it. What used to be paralyzing terror, this thing that came out of nowhere that just would descend on me and I couldn't breathe and it had me, now is fears. I think that's this immense rage to the point that if someone like John H. put his hand on my arm because I hated men, that if they put their hand on my arm that I strangled on the rage, has now become what the Big Book calls anger. I mean, it's like, so. I mean, I have defects of character. What a relief. I mean, what that means to me is I've got a character. I never had any character before, eh? You know, when I was about 13 years sober, I was sitting with my sponsor, Alabama Carruthers, I'll say her name. And I was sitting with Alabama, and I don't know, maybe you have these kind of sponsors here in Georgia. I was talking to Alabama, I don't know about what. I mean, I'm sure it was very important stuff. And right in the middle of what... See, Alabama's old. Alabama's 77 years old. Or 76 years old and been sober 37 years. And I used to do the same thing with Chuck. I figured, you know, he'd say stuff with me, and I think, you know, this guy's just old. He did not hear me. You know how you think they're just old? And every now and then I just get to thinking, Alabama's pretty old, and she's not too much here. She's just got a broken record. You know what I mean? And so I'm sitting there telling her something, and right in the middle of it, I think she's not listening. She looks at me and she says, you know, baby, I was 13 years sober. She said, you know, baby, I listen to you talk, and you talk as if the best has already happened. And I thought about that. I mean, I was sober 13 years. I've had so many miracles in my life. My God, it's not so much that you love me that's the miracle. But I told you I'd made a decision that I was never going to love anybody. That loving hurts too bad. It's not so much that you love me, but I can't tell you what it's like to love the way I do today. And to tell you, if you're new, that loving feels good. It doesn't feel bad. It doesn't hurt. Loving feels good. It's something that comes through us and not from us. Anyway, I thought about that. I've had so many miracles in my life. You know, that son I've got, that little dog or whatever he was, now wears a size 12 men's shoe. And God, I love him. You haven't lived till you've seen your son being an altar boy in those little red robes. I don't care if he does become a drunk. He'll always be an altar boy to me. But I thought about all these things that had happened, and I thought, you know, she's right. And it wasn't that I thought the best would already happen. It's just, who could ask for more? Who could ask for more? She said to me, "Baby, you talk as if the best has already happened." I thought, yeah, who could ask for more? I guess I thought my job now would just kind of pass it along and you guys get yours. And she said, "Baby, you're only a teenager." That's what you get if you got a sponsor that's over 30. She said, "You're only a teenager. I've been your length of sobriety. And I'm here to tell you, honey, that the best is yet to come." Now she said, "Honey, I want you to go home and ask your God to allow you to feel in your heart that the best is yet to come. Because I still have that grace that I take direction." I went home and I started getting on my knees. And I asked God to allow me to feel in my heart that the best was yet to come. And I'm telling you, something miraculous has happened in the last 5 years for me. That I am more enthused than I have ever been in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm more excited about your sobriety. I'm more excited about my sobriety. I want to stand up here. I wish I could tell you Linda's story. I wish I could tell you Scott's story. I wish I could tell you Bobby's story. I wish I could tell you Tom's and all the other people, that Alcoholics Anonymous is living, vibrant, new, and I am as excited today about hearing the foreword in that meeting as I was. So if you're at a program, point in your program where you've gotten stale. And it just kind of seems to be more of the same. And what the hell's it for anyway? Who cares about a newcomer? I'd like to ask you to go home tonight and get on your knees and ask your God to allow you to feel in your heart that the best is yet to come. See you next time in Atlanta. Thank you.